Good morning, everyone. I'm going to call to order this hearing of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. A quorum is present. And welcome, everyone. Glad to see you here today. Today is Elkins Day in the committee. So Representative Elkins has three different bills that we're going to hear today. And he did a lot of work over the interim. He did a lot of work last session on some of these things. And, you know, I'm sure that we're going to learn a lot today. And hopefully we're going to find some consensus around some of these things. I think that's probably what's going to happen today. So with that, the first order of business is approval of the minutes of January 26th. And do
I move to move the minutes, please?
All right. Vice Chair Bierman moves approval of the minutes of January 26th. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of approval of the minutes of January 26th, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails, and the minutes are approved. Thank you. So the first bill that we have on the agenda is House File 293. And so, Representative Elkins, I think your motion is that House File 293 be re-referred to the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. Is that right?
That is correct, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. And was there any amendment on 293?
Yes, there is a short author's amendment to this that I'd like to offer as well.
All right. So let's see here. And we don't. Okay. I don't see an amendment in our packets, Representative Elkins. On 293? Hold on one second here.
If it's not there, Madam Chair, we can I can offer it when the bill gets to Commerce. It's mostly technical amendments.
Okay. All right. So, sorry, we don't have that, Representative Elkins. Is it so it's technical and it's?
It's clarification. So
okay.
The bill was introduced. Peter Nelson, who's testifying today, came to me with several practical suggestions for clarifying provisions in the bill, which I put into that author's amendment. But they're not really substantive, so we can do them in Commerce.
Okay. And so, Representative Elkins, if we come to something related to that, maybe you can just flag it for us that's going to be a change when you get to Commerce.
Yep.
I think that would be fine. Mm-hmm. So with that, Representative Elkins, the floor is yours to present House File 293.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. So if there's a unifying theme today, all of these bills are in one way or another about healthcare pricing transparency, especially this one. These three bills were heard in this committee and in Commerce last year. They were House Files 57, 58, and 59 this year. They were heard in both committees last year, and over the interim, I was able to continue having stakeholder meetings. And the bill that's being offered today is much better. All three of them are much better than the bills that were first introduced last year. And I think that will be reflected in the testimony that you'll hear today as well. So the background behind House File 293 is that as part of the Affordable Care Act, hospitals are required to publish their prices, okay, and post them on their websites in an easily accessible place. And the rule implementing that act went into effect in 2021 at the beginning. So since the beginning of 2021, all hospitals nationwide have been required to publish their list prices. So what that rule did not do is it did not specify a format for hospitals to publish their prices. And so every hospital in the country, at least the ones that bothered to comply with the rule at all, and were assured by the Minnesota Hospital Association that every Minnesota hospital has complied with that rule, but every single hospital published it in a different format. So the objective of having them publish these rates is that so that researchers and you know organizations who might be interested in producing things like pricing comparison reports would be able to compile these published prices and show them to the public. And so the task of you know both researchers, people who wanted to publish the rates for comparison purposes, was just gargantuan. So the leading organization in terms of integrating this data and putting it to use is a California organization called Turquoise Health. You see their screen up on the screen in front of you right now. I know the CEO of Turquoise Health. They told me that they had to take data in like 800 different files and 800 different formats in order to compile the data that you'd see today, and it's just not sustainable. So I, with that, you know, I would like to probably just jump into the testifiers and call Gene Abrams from the University of Minnesota. Gene?
All right. Thank you, Representative Elkins. So we will move to testimony. And Gene Abrams, please come and we've allotted about 3 minutes for a testimony. We won't keep you too strictly to that, but we would like you to be concise if possible. So please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead and give your presentation.
Good morning, and thank you. My name is Jean Abraham. I am a professor and division head for the Health Policy and Management in the School of Public Health at the University of Minnesota and a health economist who studies private insurance and provider markets. So many privately insured individuals in this country bear significant financial exposure with respect to their healthcare utilization as a result of cost-sharing provisions, most notably high deductibles. In Minnesota, 93% of privately insured individuals face an annual deductible requirement, with average deductibles now exceeding $2,000 for single coverage and more than $4,000 for family coverage. We know from evidence that there is extensive growth in commercial health plan prices, as well as geographic specific price variation for equivalent medical services. And together, these two factors strengthen consumers' incentives to search for and use pricing information when making choices. It also affords us important opportunities to conduct economic research that informs state and federal policymaking and regulatory action to promote competitive healthcare markets. As a researcher who has been studying the implementation of the federal hospital price transparency rule, I can tell you that implementation has been slow, remains incomplete nationally, with current estimates suggesting about 65% of hospitals have published payer-specific rates as of October of 2022. On a positive note, Turquoise Health's price transparency record does indicate that the vast majority of Minnesota hospitals have reported complete data, with a few exceptions among critical access hospitals, psychiatric hospitals, and a few hospitals owned by mHealth Fairview. So as we think about this work, I would just stress that we have to think about the organizations, the pros and cons. Namely, that there are some challenges faced by organizations that must comply. For hospitals, they are already over the learning curve. For additional providers that are indicated in the proposal, that would be some new administrative burden. Specifically, as we think about, I speak from a researcher perspective, researchers across the country have begun to conduct analyses to measure hospital price variation, looking at very narrow sets of services, or to quantify how prices vary by organizational or market attributes. But the actual pricing data that's contained in the posted data files has been extremely challenging to use, given the lack of standardized data structure, as Representative Elkins mentioned. Additionally, Turquoise Health is an option for researchers, but it does require us to sign a data use agreement, and there is uncertainty about the availability of those data long run or the cost of those data. I do think that there are great benefits associated with this legislation. It will improve the accessibility and usability of Minnesota-specific provider data. That will facilitate in such a way the merging of files to be able to conduct analyses of important state policy relevant questions. Notably, we can understand how prices are changing over time for different segments of privately insured populations within local geographic markets. We can also examine the relationship between changes in prices and provider market competition, which is very important in light of continuing consolidation via merger and acquisition in both provider insurance markets. I would also simply, I would add as well that the language in the bill expands the set of providers who will be asked to report their data. And I think this is particularly important given the shift in service provision from inpatient to outpatient settings, comparing not only hospital outpatient departments, but also ambulatory surgery centers and other types of procedures that are performed in physician offices. And then finally, I would just add that a key provision within this bill includes making available a public tool. And I think this is also a value. I would simply encourage us to think about what prices mean to consumers. For certain population segments, the prices that are posted are the prices they will pay. For those who have insurance, including deductibles or other complex insurance benefit designs, those posted prices may not reflect what they may actually pay during the year. Depends on their consumption. So really, it is important to think about the trade-offs there. Finally, I would just add that for the passage of any I think overall these are very important provisions. They're valuable to different constituencies. I would also encourage us to think about evaluation if a price comparison tool is put forth and developed to really understand the value it confers to Minnesotans. And finally, as we think about our value-based healthcare delivery and financing system, the direction we want to head, I do think it's valuable for us to think about including information that reflects the multidimensionality of providers, not only prices, but also quality, safety, and patient experience. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Professor Abraham. Next, we have Stephen Parenti. Welcome to the committee. If you would, same drill, if you would just introduce yourself and then take about 3 minutes for your presentation.
Thank you. My name is Steve Parenti. I'm a professor in the Carlson School of Management, the specialty area in health economics. So I'm going to do this a cappella. I think most of what we've heard so far from Professor Abraham is very correct in the sense of what is needed for research. What I'd like to draw your attention to is something that has not been discussed as much, which is the other side of the price transparency initiative. Both these things were started by the previous presidential administration with a goal of getting consumers to have information to shop. The intent of these pieces of executive rules was to create a shopping environment that could be used actually by app developers like a Turquoise Health to be made available to other folks. Unfortunately, that nirvana is not quite coming immediately. And the reason why is that the data structures, as Professor Abraham has alluded to, are quite disorganized and somewhat rambling in certain of their structures. That is the case for the hospital price transparency rule. What I'd like to draw your attention to is the cousin of that rule, which is the insurer price transparency rule. That was supposed to start January 1 of last year. It started actually in July 1 of 2022. And what it requires is every insurer across the United States, as well as self-insured employer plans, to disclose all of their negotiated prices with physicians and hospitals. So, and actually every single provider that they have. This includes not just physicians, but also allied health professionals, certified social workers, you name it. And the rule also says that those the insurers must disclose this information every month. And they've been doing so since July 1. Actually, they've been doing so in such a way that in one monthly distribution of this data is equal to the video libraries of Amazon, Hulu, Disney Plus, and Netflix. Ooh. Does it have to be that way? No. The insurers have actually been very, shall we say, clever in the way they've actually structured their data. However, an examination of the data by self-preliminary basis with Professor Abraham at our supercomputing center at the University of Minnesota has shown that all the data actually is intact. It's just very complicated to get that information out the door. What I would like to draw your attention to is the fact that that information, if perhaps, is far more comprehensive than what is actually coming through the hospital price transparency rule. And more importantly, it's structured with a required set of fields that were actually put into the federal rule. And all of those fields are actually present. The challenge is basically unpacking that data. But Turquoise Health and other vendors are actually working toward that goal. Even academics like myself are working exactly toward that goal to disentangle it and hope to have something within a year to actually share so that this vision can actually go forward. But just in closing, when we think about additional requirements for disclosure, I would say this cousin coming from the insurers is something that we should at least see how it unfolds. It does have far more comprehensive and structured standardized data than what the hospital price transparency rule has developed. Researchers like Professor Abraham and myself have yet to get a hold of it because it's so complicated, but the initial analysis shows that it actually has the same price information, fortunately, as what the hospitals are reporting. So it could be another way to attack this issue. And thank you very much for
all right,
the opportunity.
Thank you for your testimony. And so next on the list I have Peter Nelson, but I understand he wants to testify to more than just the bill, or come on down, Mr. Nelson. I don't know if Representative Elkins, if you are you ready for Mr. Nelson? Or
yep.
Okay, great. Welcome to the committee. And Mr. Nelson, I understand you wanted to talk about more than just this bill, and how did you care to proceed here?
I can have comments on some of the other bills as well. However, my focus would be on this bill. So this
okay,
is definitely
well, why don't you go ahead and take the 3 minutes if you need to, and then, you know, if there's something specific to one of the other bills, of course, you can come back up.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Peter Nelson, and I'm a senior fellow with Center of the American Experiment. And a few years ago, I was actually working at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and in that role, I led some of this price transparency effort that you have previously heard about in the past testimony here. And in particular, I focused on the health plan price transparency rule that Professor Plenty just referenced. And I was the lead person in charge of managing the drafting of that rule at CMS. And so I've gained a lot of experience on how these rules operate and how they operate together. And the hospital rule, as Professor Parenti explained, has not been administered. It has not basically come out with the sort of standardized format that we would have hoped that it would have provided. And so it's been harder to manage that data, and it's been harder to pull that data together and aggregate it in a way that's going to be meaningful in the future for consumers to use. And so this piece of legislation would help that problem significantly by requiring that information to be standardized. And in addition to that, it also addresses some issues that the federal government couldn't address at the time. The federal government had statutory authority to require hospitals to report some of this information. It did not have statutory authority to require other medical settings to report this information. And so this bill would move in that direction, where it would actually create some sort of equity within the healthcare system to require a similar level of reporting from across the healthcare system. And that's incredibly important, because when you look back at how prices have emerged, because generally speaking, prices have been hidden, and we've never really known the price of anything in the healthcare system, especially before you buy it. And in Minnesota, we had some requirements back in the day that required some level of price transparency, and there was some voluntary level of price transparency. So if you recall, going back to even before the Affordable Care Act was passed, I believe it was Minnesota Community Measurement provided some pricing on their website. I think it was like the 100 most used procedures at hospitals. And we saw some variation across hospitals. And that information actually told us that some of the things we were hearing about the healthcare system weren't exactly right. Dartmouth University had an important study that showed Medicare pricing across the country. And it suggested that the Mayo Clinic was an incredibly high-value place to get care, and where it was high quality yet low cost. Yet here in Minnesota, I think we all understood that, yes, it's an incredible hospital system with very high quality, but it was still very costly. And that's what that pricing information showed. But that was very narrowly based. We have now been able to get a lot more data. Some of this data has come from employer-based health plans that have now shown what's helped us understand more about what's going on in the healthcare system, and we've seen this incredible variation that Professor Abraham talked about, and we've seen the need for these price transparency efforts that the federal government pursued and that we're now pursuing today. And I think this is just a further evolution of that process to finally get us to the place where we all have the pricing information we need to make the best choices, care choices for our families. And so I support this provision very strongly, and I think it will hopefully finally wrap this up and give us the rules in place that we need to finally get full price transparency within our healthcare system.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Nelson. Okay. So are there any other members in the audience who wish to testify on this bill? Okay. Not seeing anyone, so we'll close the testimony then, Representative Elkins, and we'll go to member questions and discussion. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Elkins. I love price transparency. I think this is an important component. I also work for government, and I know how difficult it is to actually take all this data that we require and then get it out into a format that that is usable for the public. And so my questions have to do really with basically subdivision 3. Is this a one-time thing, or is this ongoing?
Ongoing.
Okay. Because the bill just says January 24th, and I don't see where it says it's going to continue.
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, it would. This act would take an effect for prices as of January 1st, 2024.
Okay.
Okay. And in the amendment, we're not seeing it. It gives the additional providers, the non-hospital providers, until the beginning of 2025, because they'll be developing from scratch, whereas the hospitals, all they have to do is take their existing files and rearrange the order of the columns.
Sure.
And then, Nadeau.
Madam Chair, thank you. Can you talk about, is there adequate time? So they're going to submit the information by the 1st of January. And it's to be available to the public by July 1st of the same year. That's not a ton of time, it doesn't seem like to me. Is that going to be adequate time to compile that data and then put it in a usable form that somebody like I could understand it and utilize it?
Representative Elkins.
It's an excellent question. I may have to cut MDH some slack on that, but the reason I've got this up on the screen right now is that there's been a lot of testimony this morning about this organization, Turquoise Health. They already have a tool stood up, so if I just enter in here, total hip replacement.
I think that was a good softball question for you, Representative Elkins. I think you were ready.
Okay.
You're welcome, Madam Chair.
Okay, so what I will see is your total hip replacement. Wait a minute. I need to. It's giving me the prices, or should give me the prices. What did I do wrong? Should be.
Just 32 results. I think you have to click see all rates.
Sometimes the magic works and sometimes it doesn't here. I'm going to do another
bad
one.
Day.
All right. Well, anyway, I think we get the idea, Representative Elkins. Trying to do technology in public is always dangerous.
This one's coming up right up. Okay. Okay, here we go. So this is a particular CT scan. The data, so Turquoise Health has taken the data submitted by Minnesota hospitals in all of their different formats and has spent millions of dollars to compile the data into this tool. But you can see that at Children's Specialty Hospital, it's $1,783.80. The same thing at Regions Hospital, a few miles away, is $183.51. At United Hospital, also here in St. Paul, $462.53. So there's already tools that do this. The Act gives MDH the ability to contract with a vendor to provide the tool. What I expect to happen is that MDH will make a contract with Turquoise to provide this tool with an MDH logo on it.
Okay.
All right. One more representative, because
yep,
we have other members.
Thing. So I don't know anything about Turquoise Health, and you said it's a California company. Are there, I mean, are there companies in Minnesota, and I know that the language of the bill says they may contract with a third party for the development, and you stated that you expect them to, are there any affiliations that the state has with Turquoise? Has we funded them? Do any of our department people have an interest in Turquoise Health? I just want to make sure that there's a separation so that there's an equal playing field for Minnesota companies who want to take this data and actually do the same thing. Is that the case?
Well, Representative Joe, there's nothing in the bill about Turquoise Health. No. So, Representative Elkins.
Testifier mentioned that he expected the state.
Madam Chair, I just say that I expect that that there will be competitors to Turquoise Health. And, as the chair says, there's nothing in here that sells Turquoise Health. But, you know, I just given the current state of the landscape, my opinion is that currently Turquoise Health has the best tool on the market.
Thank you, Representative Elkins.
All right. We'll go on to Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Elkins. Just two questions today, and actually following up on Representative Nadeau's last question there. But the first one is on line 2.19, the floor of $50 million. Where did that number come from, and how much of the overall market do you expect will be covered under that amount?
Representative Elkins.
It's kind of pulled out of the air to some degree. We didn't want to burden very small organizations that wouldn't have the resources to assemble the data. So as I stated earlier, all Minnesota hospitals, regardless of size, are required to comply with the federal law. But some of the other organizations that would come in 2025, the Twin Cities Orthopedics, the TRIAs, some of the surgical centers, they're on different platforms that may not have the expertise, and so we didn't, at least initially, I didn't want to burden smaller organizations that don't already have the capability to comply with this, to develop, to have to comply with it out of the gate.
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I guess Representative Elkins, I would have thought there was an algorithm you would have drawn somewhere, a slideshow that you could have had for us on that one. But just on the second point, and kind of with what, in the same vein of what Representative Nadeau was asking, and I asked you this last year when this bill was up, with Minnesota community measurements, how this compares to that, will this make that service obsolete? That's the one I always send my constituents to when they're asking about things. What aren't they doing that this would allow them to do? Would they be one of those potential contract pieces? Just kind of how this works with that group. Thank
sure.
you, Madam Chair.
Representative Elkins.
Madam Chair, I greatly admire the work that Minnesota Community Measurement does. Their scope, though, as has been testified to earlier, is limited to about analyzing about 100 specific procedures. Any time that I have gone to the Minnesota Community Measurement website to get some pricing insights into procedures that I myself was facing, never once found a procedure that I was facing to be on the list of 100 or so procedures that they that is within their purview. But they could, they have developed a fairly impressive capability. And we might want to consider that with the data in a consistent, easily consumable format, it might be something that they might want to do. And it would be much more feasible with the format of the data standardized for them to do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. So we have Murphy, Quam, and Perryman, and then I'm going to, hopefully we can get to a vote on this bill. And let me just say, I don't believe we have a fiscal note on it yet. Correct.
Mr. Carney requested fiscal notes on these bills promptly. They have not been forthcoming, so we'll deal with them when we get to Commerce.
Yeah, and just so members know, and this one will impact the health budget because it impacts the Commissioner of Health.
Yeah.
So, we will make sure that this committee gets to examine the fiscal note before this goes to the floor, for example, or maybe it'll go in an omnibus bill. We're not really sure at this point. So. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question really is about full disclosure. It seems to me like the question that's never asked is, what is the cash price of doing business? That would incorporate insurance. It would incorporate a lot of different things. It would be a better estimate. I'm a member of a healthcare co-op, mm-hmm. And that's what we ask, and it really gives you a good idea of what the healthcare provider is able to do, what fits his profit, but also it is the best measurement for a patient to really understand what is my true cost of care here. And then you can move from there. But my question is there's nothing that's ever talked about with cash rather than just standard charges. I want to know what they charge for a cash price.
Representative Elkins.
Thank you. Yes, so the federal rule requires hospitals to publish their list price, which nobody ever pays, and their cash price, and the price for each insurance plan. So you could actually go into the turquoise tool right now and know what it would cost you as a member of Medica, for example. But the cash price is the one that you're actually seeing on the display.
Okay. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the chair probably remembers when we did a study on hospitals, and they ended up having a poor mark for Mayo. And when I talked to the U of M statistician that worked on the formula, there wasn't a factor for difficulty for readmission. And when we're looking at these prices, the first thing that popped to my mind is there are some people, when you're going to CT, they have to use a special system or a different one they're scheduled to for various reasons. So the complexity and the other factors that figure into cost, I know there are some times where it's more expensive for pediatrics because, children don't always aren't comfortable with, being in a tunnel and other stuff, and you've got specially designed equipment for pediatrics so that they're more at ease and you can more quickly and effectively treat. So I'd like the author to reassure me that when we go through this, we just don't have a generic thing, and we overlook very important factors in the calculation because, if I remember correctly, Madam Chair, they had to redo their assessment formula to appropriately take into account these other factors. And if we're going to do the same thing here, let's up front make sure we take those considerations in so we don't have misleading factors.
Yeah, so Representative Quam, you and I are well trained. Yes, we are. Representative Elkins, how does value figure into this,
ways,
if at all?
First of all, for the hospitals, especially inpatient, the vast majority of the charges are bundles called diagnosis-related groups, and the prices for diagnosis-related groups is adjusted for the complexity of the diagnosis that's being treated. Second thing, and the reason I put this back out here, is that turquoise, every hospital has a Medicare 4, 1 to 5 star rating, and in their tool they have integrated those in so that you can see, for example, that United Hospital here in St. Paul has a 4-star rating. So they are integrating quality data with the price data so a consumer can look at both.
Okay, short follow-up.
Very short. I would appreciate being able to see the factors and some of the formula evaluation criteria so I can hopefully understand and maybe we can avoid a miscue that we had before. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Perriman, and then we're going to go to a vote.
Very quick clarifications. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. I'm just curious on the $50 million revenue threshold, and maybe I missed it, but is it gross or net that would be the threshold? And just some thoughts, quick thoughts, of how you determined the $50 million threshold.
Representative Elkins.
I think that question was asked earlier. It's just plain old gross, and it was just kind of pulled out of the air.
Okay, and may I follow up, Chair? Representative, my follow-up would just be that there's healthcare communities out there that are small, and I'm just wondering if there's been consideration, too, about how those patients will find out this kind of information from the smaller clinics.
Representative Elkins.
Madam Chair, it only applies to hospitals. All hospitals, by federal law, are required to publish this information. I will add that I've had a nice peace offering from the Hospital Association, and they have offered to work with me during the interim. I'm a healthcare informaticist by education, to help the smaller hospitals comply with the rule.
Great. Thank you, Representative, and thank you, Chair.
All right. With that, members, Representative Elkins, short closing.
Yeah, just right. So we had a good discussion here this morning, but the gist of this bill is that it requires the hospitals to take this data that they've already been required to publish since the beginning of 2021, put it into a consistent format. It's a format that was developed by a CMS technical expert panel that they convened last year. I actually chaired that panel. It was half hospitals, half people who wanted to consume the data. We came up with a consensus on what that format should be. They have published it on the Hospital Pricing Transparency website for CMS, and the bill basically that would require Minnesota hospitals to use that standard format.
All right, so Representative Elkins renews his motion that House File 293 be re-referred to the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to Commerce. All right, now we have House File 294, and Representative Elkins moves that House File 294 be re-referred to the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. Is that right, Representative Elkins?
Correct, Madam Chair.
And then, Representative Elkins, for this one, you do have an amendment, and I think we had two different authors' amendments. We had an A1 and an A2, and could you...
Yeah.
Okay,
Chair,
so it's the A1?
The A1 is author's amendment. I made a mistake in my instructions to Mr. Chun on the drafting of this bill originally. I had asked that it be done based on the second engrossment of House File 58 last year, and I did not do my homework. There were subsequent amendments to that bill that were offered after the second engrossment. So the author's amendment includes those additional amendments that were very important that were made at the end of last session.
All right. So Representative Elkins moves the A1 author's amendment to get the bill in the order in which he would like to have it discussed. All those in favor of adoption of the A1, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. So, Representative Elkins, two-year bill as amended.
Yep. So, very briefly, this bill has two parts. The overriding objective of this bill is to provide a measure of stability to the formularies in health plans, the drug formularies. Drug formularies are the only aspect of a health plan where under state and federal law, health plans can change the conditions during the course of the plan year. In all other respects, a health plan has to abide by the coverages that it represented during open enrollment that the patient signed up for that preceding plan year. But health plans have, for some reason, always been allowed to change their drug formularies during the course of the year. And that may mean that in some cases a patient who signed up for a particular health plan because their drug was on the formulary may find in the middle of the year that all of a sudden their health plan is telling them, you can't take this drug, you have to take this other drug instead. So there are good reasons, there are valid reasons why a health plan would want to do this. The most common one that's cited now is that a new, less expensive, either generic or patented alternative may come onto the market that's quite a bit cheaper, and health plans will want to steer patients towards towards those new drugs. But sometimes the new drug isn't an exact equivalent, or a particular patient might not find that it works as well for them as the one they were on. We'll hear testimony about that. So this bill has gone through a lot of permutations, but in this iteration of it, it basically says health plans and your PBMs, you're allowed to change your formulary over the course of the year in response to these events with some advance notice, but the one thing you can't do is kick somebody off a drug that was on the formulary when they signed up for the plan until the end of the next plan year when the patient has an opportunity to reevaluate what plan they want to sign up for. So that's all it does. So I'm going to get one example of where the PBMs are telling me they have the most leverage is where a new cheaper drug comes onto the market, and there's a report that's in your handouts from Milliman that they commissioned. It gives a specific example about the class of drugs that are used to treat hepatitis C. Unique thing about those drugs is that they're a rare example of drugs that actually cures a disease. So you take a 12-week course of one of these drugs, and you're cured. So under my bill, they use the example of when a new drug called Mavyret came into the market at a price that was 65% below that of the two established drugs, Harvoni and Epclusa. And so naturally, health plans would want to say, okay, we don't want to use Humira or Epclusa anymore. We want you to use Mavyret. And a health plan under this bill could still do that. But what they couldn't do is to say somebody who's on already halfway through their course of treatment with Humira that, nope, we're taking you off Humira and putting you on Mavyret, and then make them start the course of treatment all over again. So that's the extent of the restriction that is there. But even that protection is very important to the medical community. And so with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to go to our testifiers.
All right. Thank you, Representative Elkins. So we have Alex Vasuni. Dr. Vasuni? There she is. All right. And testifiers on this one, we're gonna keep you to 2 minutes. I'm sorry about that, but we are running a little bit behind. We want to get through the bills today. So if you can, we're going to time you just to make sure that we all stay on track here. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, I am Alex Vasuni, a family physician practicing in West St. Paul, and I'm the president of the Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians. I'm here today representing the Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians, as well as the Minnesota Medical Association, both of whom are in strong support of HF-294. As a physician, my first goal is to work with my patients to determine what is needed for their treatment. As a family physician, I have many patients who have chronic conditions where the treatments can last for years. Patients with rheumatoid arthritis, asthma, mental illness, and more. For these patients, it is critical that we find and maintain the right treatment regimens so that their condition does not worsen and that they can stay engaged with their families and their communities. It is infuriating when I have a patient stabilized on a medication that is working for them, and I hear that their insurer or PBM changes its formulary mid-year, forcing my patient to change from a medication that is effective for them. This disruption is frustrating and inconvenient for both patients and providers. It seems unfair that although the patient is locked into a contract with their health plan, a contract they may have chosen specifically because their drugs were on the formulary at the start of the year, changes to that contract might result in them not getting the care that they need, as the patient does not have the opportunity to choose to go to another health plan until the end of his or her enrollment year. For many conditions, changing from one drug to another in the same drug class can work fine. But for certain conditions, like mental illness, epilepsy, multiple sclerosis, and others, changing medication mid-treatment can put a patient at severe risk. You will hear that these changes are done in the name of savings costs. But if a patient cannot get their medication in a timely fashion and ends up in the emergency room, it ends up costing both the patient and the healthcare system so much more. HF-294 does not prohibit PBMs from changing their formularies throughout the year. They can add new drugs when they believe there is a benefit. They can add a new generic when it becomes available. They can always add new drugs that may be more cost-effective for the patient. But what the bill would prohibit is forcing a patient to switch drugs once they have started a therapy that was originally covered by the PBM until the end of their enrollment year. You also need to know the damages and the costs these formulary changes and administrative barriers are having on physicians and other prescribers. In many health systems across the Twin Cities, we have entire departments who are dedicated to spending their time on the phone with insurers and PBMs appealing medical decisions that are being made by someone other than the provider that is directly treating the patient, trying to understand why the medication was changed and trying to convince them that their decision is not in the best interest of the patient. While we are successful many times in getting an appeal and getting medication covered, care is delayed for the patient and administrative costs and the hassle factors are increasing.
So let me have to ask you to wrap up, please.
Yes. I ask you to support HF-294, and I support applying this to both the public and private payers. Thank you. I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you very much. Next is Bentley Graves, and then we have Christina Moorhead on deck. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Bentley Graves. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. At the Minnesota Chamber, we represent more than 6,000 employers and more than 500,000 employees all across the state, every corner of the state, every industry and every size of business. We work on healthcare issues because of the cost considerations for our employer members and for their employees. I want to thank, first of all, Representative Elkins for the incredible work he's done across these bills for many years to really kind of carry the torch of transparency and usability for patients and also for payers. He's done great work, and there's much between these bills that we agree with and we support. But I'm here today to kind of raise one concern about House File 294, and that does have to do with the restrictions on the ability to change formularies. Between the mandate review report that was done on this bill last year, various fiscal notes that have come over the preceding years, the Milliman report that Representative Elkins mentioned, there are not insignificant cost considerations to take into account with a change like this. And this is a conversation that we have had for many years now, look forward to continuing that conversation with Representative Elkins as this bill moves through. Understanding, too, as the last point that was made by the last testifier, there have been different standards for commercial plans and private plans in this bill. I think at the moment they apply the same standard to both, we will get a sense of the kind of the fiscal impact of that at some point down the line. But just want to here today kind of put a pin in the cost considerations attached to this bill and commit ourselves to working with Representative Elkins going forward. But thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to testify today. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Christina Moorhead and then Joe Selwood. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Christina Moorhead. I'm with the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, or PhRMA. We represent the innovative pharmaceutical companies. We'd like to express support for Article 2 of the bill. We believe that this information is really helpful to plan sponsors and patients in making informed decisions on their health care and which prescription drugs work best for them. We do have some concerns with Article 1 of the bill, which is additional manufacturer transparency reporting, and as amended now requires 90 days notice to increase the wholesale acquisition cost of a drug. So I want to briefly just talk about wholesale acquisition cost of a drug. This is the list price of a drug. And I also want to talk about the role of PBMs. We have three PBMs who control 80% of the marketplace, so they have significant leverage with pharmaceutical manufacturers to negotiate discounts and rebates. That is not included in the wholesale acquisition price of the drug. These rebates in 2021 totaled more than $236 billion. When you calculate that into the increase in net price growth, that's only 1% in that year. On average, these discounts and rebates lower the cost of a brand prescription drug by 49%. Additionally, PBMs often negotiate a price protection rebate during a contract year, and what this does is if the wholesale acquisition cost of the drug increases during that time frame, they would get an additional rebate or discount that would hold them insulated really on the originally negotiated price of the drug. So our concern with reporting wholesale acquisition costs and also average wholesale price are these are not the prices that patients pay for the drug. They should be paying at least a discounted price for that prescription medicine. We also have concerns that this additional transparency reporting is a little bit premature. We've yet to see the state release the data from the Prescription Drug Transparency Act of 2020. There's about a year's worth of data that they have collected. We should see information publicly posted and to legislative reports, and we have not seen that information yet. So we have concerns about additional information when we haven't seen the information that drug manufacturers have currently reported. So I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. And we have Joe Selwood. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Joe Selwood, and I'm testifying on behalf of the Association for Accessible Medicines, the leading trade association for manufacturers of generic and biosimilar medicines. There's a letter from AAM in your packet that outlines their opposition to House File 294, as well as the benefits of generics and biosimilars, the segment of the prescription drug marketplace that provides savings for consumers. Some basic facts. Generic drugs are 91% of drugs dispensed, but only 18% of the cost. Generic drugs make up only 2% of the total healthcare spend. House File 294 is unnecessary, will cause patient confusion, and will not result in the cost of any drugs going down. It would require drug manufacturers that produce a drug with a wholesale acquisition cost of $100 or more to report information to the state regardless of the amount of savings these medications provide. House File 294 requires the state to post the WAC price information, which generally doesn't reflect what a patient pays. Particularly when there are multiple manufacturers of the same drug, there may be an outlier reporting a high WAC, but other manufacturers may be much lower. The state posting of the WAC information will not inform the patient of what their actual out-of-pocket costs are, and many may decide not to fill their prescriptions. On formulary changes, House File 294 does not allow for formulary changes to include a biosimilar medication. On average, the cost of a biosimilar is 50% lower than the cost of a reference biologic. And biosimilars bring significant competition into the market. Delaying patient access means that patients pay more. Because this bill causes duplicative reporting, the posting of information that will confuse patients and keeps lower cost biosimilars off the market, AAM opposes the bill. Thank you for the opportunity to speak, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to come and testify on this bill? Mr. Nelson, please come down. Welcome back. Please, Madam, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Peter Nelson. I'm a senior policy fellow at Center of the American Experiment. I just want to note a couple things. First off, I think when you think about all three of these bills, they're really a package to address some holes in price transparency that exists right now. And this one focuses on drug pricing, of course. And drug prices are very important to consumers because that's where we spend a lot of our money out of pocket. And unfortunately, the health plan price transparency rule that I worked on in the prior administration has not come to full fruition yet. And we knew that we were going to get litigation in response to that rule, and sure enough, we did. The PBMs did file a lawsuit on that rule, and that lawsuit was pulled back, but I think part of what happened in that process was that CMS has delayed the application of the prescription drug pricing requirements that were put in that rule. And those were from some very strong requirements. And so there's a void there in prescription drug pricing that consumers are not going to be able to see for the time being. And this doesn't completely fill that void, but it really helps. And in regards to posting the WAC price, that price is available through some private vendors if you want to pay some money to get that price. And so it's not like it's truly a hidden price, but for the average person, they can't get access to that price. And so I think this bill is an important bill to fill that in. And the prior testifier is correct. It's not the exact price that always matters to the patient, but it gives you an anchor price to understand some variation. So I think this is a good bill. This portion of the bill is good. And so thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Anyone else? Okay. Well, so we'll close testimony. Representative Elkins, and I do have a member on the list. So let's go to questions then. Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the author. We all know that for years medications have been the biggest slice of the pie for medical costs. There are two things that I'm curious that haven't really been addressed. One is refund kickback information, which is a major component of the dollars floating around in here, but yet that transparency isn't included in the bill. And the other is special treatment of off formula with PGX indicators, so that you avoid a costly reaction to a medication and you actually get the medication that you're going to respond to, that individualized medicine. And that would actually help the healthcare outcome disparities, and be nice if we had a formulary bill that address that to make it more mainstream and accessible. So those are the two things that I see lacking in this bill.
Okay, let's go to, and we'll hold responses if that's okay, Representative Elkins. So Representative Nadeau, then we have Bonner, then New Brindley. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Elkins. I have three really quick questions. The first two, I think, are yes or no. I just want to confirm that the amendment actually fixed what I read in the earlier bill that prohibited plans from changing their formula completely within a calendar year, correct? So now they can do it as long as they notify the commissioner. The commissioner doesn't have any comment or approval authority. They just have to notify.
That's correct.
Okay. And the second thing is brought up by one.
No, I'm sorry. This is, I know it's hard to get used to this really stilted procedure we have, but we got to do it, okay?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I want to go as quickly as possible.
No, I get it. Thank you. So do I.
I apologize. The second one was brought up by one of the testifiers, and they talked about how CMS backed off because they got sued by the PBMs. Does anything in the requirements here open us up to be sued by someone by requesting this information?
Representative Elkins.
Representative Nadeau, I have studied the case law in this area quite extensively, and I'm confident that that there's nothing that we could be successfully sued over. And we can discuss that offline later.
Thank you.
Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then my final question goes back to the original example that you had with Humira and Maverick. There's nothing in this bill that would prevent a doctor and a patient who started the treatment of Humira. All of a sudden, Maverick comes on to the thing. If a doctor decides and the patient agrees that they want to change to a different, they want to change to Maverick, they can still do that. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Representative Elkins.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Madam Chair. So it just, in most cases, that would happen. If a new drug comes on the market and it comes onto the formulary, the cheaper tier, most people are going to switch. It's just but it's not always the case.
Okay.
Yep.
Representative Nadeau, final
just
question.
One quick one, final one. Mm-hmm. So I was very surprised. I've heard about these rebates, and I didn't realize that $236 billion in rebates, and I don't know if that seems like a lot of money to me.
It is.
Does anything in this bill actually, are the rebates going to be discussed? Is that part of the reporting in this, where we will be able to see maybe how Minnesota Care? I mean, does the state get rebates from in this? Does the state get rebates, and will they report?
Representative Elkins.
Yes. So the question of rebates is extremely complicated. I actually have another bill in the works related to rebates. That will be offered later in the session. On average, manufacturers are only netting about half of their wholesale acquisition costs, list price. So we don't have time to really do that today, but again, I would spend as much time as you want walking that through. I've spent a lot of time in the weeds on this stuff.
All right, and let me just add to that. I don't know if anyone from DHS is here today in the room, but I think that the federal law prohibits the state from revealing the rebates under medical assistance, at least. I'm not sure about Minnesota Care, but maybe, I don't know if staff here can confirm that. Mr. Chun, is that something you can confirm? But I think that's the case.
Madam Chair, I know that DHS has testified before about their limitations of revealing rebate information for medical assistance. I'm not as certain about Minnesota Care, but I think they use sort of the same rebate format, so the same restrictions most likely apply.
Right. So that's federal law, just to add to the discussion here. So, okay. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Elkins, for bringing this bill forward. You know that I'm a fan of this particular bill. It is one that I have fought against for quite some time. And the reason is because this bill is really at its root about consumer protection. It's about mid-year formulary changes in which we have patients who are held to a contract in which we choose a formulary based on a certain set of criteria, and then we have the rules of the game change on us halfway through the plan year. However, patients don't have the luxury at that point to shop or to change. They have to stay with what they do. We know that every drug impacts a person's body and chemistry very differently. drugs that work for an individual and when they're changed to another can cause all kinds of problems and wreak all sorts of havoc. For the patient, it could be lower health outcomes, lost wages if they have to take time off work or end up hospitalized. For employers, this means more time off of work, lower productivity. It means all kinds of things throughout the system. And why do we do these mid-formulary changes? Let's get to the root of that. A lot of times what we really are doing is sometimes it's about finding a lower cost. That's true. Sometimes it's about things like rebates. But you know, in the rebate game, the net loser in that equation is almost always the consumer. And this bill is directly aimed at putting the consumer back in the driver's seat and at least one small piece of the equation. And so I'm really grateful to Representative Elkins for bringing this forward, and I support the bill.
All right, thank you. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just quickly before I direct questions to the author, I assume that this will also have a fiscal note and that it would come back to the committee again before it moves wherever it's going to move.
I'm sorry, you were asking where it's going to, I'm sorry.
I apologize. I assume that this will also have a fiscal note, and so I'm hoping that this one would also come back to the committee for possible inclusion or to move to the floor at that
point. Right, of course. Representative New Brindley, if the fiscal note is within our committee jurisdiction, that's the defining issue here.
Yeah. Certainly. Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Can you just let us know? I'm very concerned. In fact, I've referenced this in different committees, that we are already supposed to have this report. We were supposed to have it nearly a year ago, and the language on line 5.1 is going to push out the legislative report until 2024. So over a year from now, we were supposed to receive it last May, and on January 1st, 15th, there was supposed to be a second report already, and we haven't seen anything, and now this pushes it out another, like I said, over a year. Can you let us know why we're doing that?
Representative Elkins.
Yeah, I think this, I would need somebody from MDH to answer that question. If I don't know if there's anyone.
Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Stefan Gildemeister. I direct the Health Economics Program in the Department of Health. And our team has been spending 2022 on taking in about 2,000 data on 2,000 drugs from about several hundred manufacturers. And representative, the report and a very pretty dashboard is in the approval process. So I apologize for the delay in getting it to the legislature, but it should be coming up in the next week or two at the latest.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, so we don't actually need this to push out another year. You're saying in the next couple of weeks we'll have this available. Did I understand that correctly?
Mr. Gildemeister.
Madam Chair, Representative, the data that is currently governed under the Price Transparency Act is on a reporting schedule that is sort of annual, and that should be coming out in the next 2 weeks at the latest.
All right. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that information. And perhaps, Representative Elkins, then maybe we could amend this in a future committee to bring that in alignment so that we're not pushing this out when we don't actually need to.
Representative Elkins.
Yeah, Madam Chair, so this bill expands the scope of the drug data that would need to be provided by MDH. That date just refers to the expanded data.
Representative Brindley, final question here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It actually changes the original date. The language on line 5.11 changes the original date, so we might want to consider that moving forward, especially since it sounds like that information is indeed available. The last question that I have is, you know, we have a letter and from the information we had, I don't remember last time we heard this, was it last year or 2 years ago, but there was a significant cost to this proposal, And so I'm wondering if you can walk us through a little bit what the current appeals process is. What I've heard is that when there are formulary changes, actually there is an appeals process in place already, and that has to happen within 90 days, and that actually the majority of those appeals are granted.
Representative Elkins.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure what that refers to. It may be some of the government programs, but there isn't anything new in here related to an appeals process. This bill, last session's version of this, House File 58, was put through the mandate review process, and it was determined that it wasn't a mandate according to the law. Financial impact to the to plans more generally was not measurable. If you look at the Milliman report, it would have estimated that if you'd done a full formulary freeze, which is not, the impact on plan premiums would have been in the order of 0.2 to 0.4%. Where all the drama was last time on those fiscal notes were related to the State Employees Group Insurance Plan and the DHS Medicaid plans, and that's what we're waiting for the fiscal notes on.
All right. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do think this bill has some great ties and is vital to consumer protection, so I'd like to request a roll call.
All right. A roll call having been requested, there will be a roll call. And seeing no further discussion, the clerk will take the roll. Oh, and before we do that, I should say that Representative Elkins renews his motion that House File 294, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce, Finance, and Policy.
Chair Liebling.
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Vice Chair Bierman.
Bierman, aye.
Bierman, aye. Lead Schumacher.
Schumacher, no.
Schumacher, no. Representative Akam.
Akam, aye.
Akam, aye. Representative Backer.
Backer, no.
Backer, no. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Carroll.
Aye.
Carroll, aye. Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Elkins, aye. Representative Fisher.
Fisher, aye.
Fisher, aye. Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
Aye.
Hemmingson-Yeager, aye. Representative Herr. Excused. Representative Keel.
Keel, no.
Keel, no. Representative Murphy.
No.
Murphy, no. Representative Nadeau.
Aye.
Nadeau, aye. Representative New Brindley.
No.
New Brindley, no. Representative Perryman.
No.
Perryman, no. Representative Quam.
No.
Quam, no. Representative Ryer.
Aye.
Ryer, aye. Representative Smith.
Aye.
Smith, aye.
There being 11 ayes and 7 nays, the motion prevails and the bill is on its way to Commerce. Thank you, Representative Elkins. And now we're going to move to House File 926. And the motion here, again, will be that House File 926 be re-referred to the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. I don't think there's an amendment on this one. Is there, Representative Elkins? Oh, there is?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Let's see here.
Madam Chair.
Representative Elkins.
Yeah, so this one is kind of the successor in some regards to my House File 59 last year, but we're using as kind of a vehicle for all things all payer claims database, House File 921, which was originally okay. More narrowly
Representative
scoped.
Elkins, I'm sorry, you're a little bit ahead of me here.
Okay.
Are we, so did you want to adopt the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape in which you want to discuss it?
I would, thank you,
Madam. All right, so well, why don't we adopt the amendment and then you can describe the bill as amended because the amendment, I think, is somewhat substantial. So, Representative Elkins moves the A1 amendment. All in favor of the A1, please say aye. Any opposed? The motion prevails. The A1 is adopted. So to your bill as amended, Representative Elkins, and we do need to be brief because we need to finish up here in just a few minutes. So Representative Elkins.
Very briefly, the bill eliminates the sunset date of July 1st this year on use of the All Payer Claims database, requires that payments, incentive value-based payments be submitted to MDH as well. And then the amendment includes provisions that I had in the bill last year that would have that would allow MDH to use the data for pricing comparison and to publish that information. We've got dental information coming in for the same at the same time. What else?
All right. So
race and ethnicity data to the extent that it's available.
Representative Elkins, so we have Mr. Gildemeister is here from the Department of Health, and he was going to give us a very brief sort of introduction to what we're talking about here, what the APCD is, because we, of course, didn't do overviews, so we thought it would be good to just have a very brief introduction to what this is. So, Mr. Gildemeister.
Madam Chair, again, for the record, my name is Stefan Gildemeister. I direct the Health Economics Program, and we do analysis on healthcare cost, access, insurance coverage, and disease burden, and look at the effectiveness of the healthcare market. As part of that, we maintain the Minnesota APCD, the Minnesota All Payer Claims Database. Really in brief, and I have 14 slides, Chair, I will show maybe four. Really brief, the All Payer Claims Database is a data asset the legislature developed to really inform key questions in the area of healthcare spending, system efficiency and waste, healthcare quality, disease patterns in the state, public health, and the functioning of the healthcare market. It is a large-scale data system that really collects and integrates data from the process of paying for healthcare in the state. So it's not a data set that's been built for researchers to have fun with it, but rather it is a byproduct of paying for healthcare in Minnesota. So it, a provider submits a claim for payment by to an insurance company. The insurance company looks at the contract with that provider and pays the agreed on amount and identifies the cost sharing for individuals. So what's in the data are essentially enrollment records, medical and drug claims, and the prices of procedures delivered. It is a extraordinarily rich data set for diagnosed information in Minnesota, treatment delivered to Minnesota residents, and servicing provider and provider type. These data are de-identified. That means a lot of information that you would think of as protected and personal are not really included in the data. There's no patient name, no date of birth, no social security number. Patient address is not there, just the zip code. And then other information that oftentimes shows up in research, like income or detail from electronic records, are also not in the data. This is a claims database. And I forgot to mention, this database is established by collecting data from Medicaid, Medicare, and the commercial market. There are about 2 billion claims for about 11 years of data, again, across the section of diagnostic information, procedures, hospital stays, and drug claims. The data currently is available in a limited form. The legislature limited access and use of the data to the health department, and we use it, as I mentioned, for analysis of healthcare cost, quality, utilization, illness burden and variation across the state. And the data are accessible through the research findings and briefs and reports and short takes and slides that we develop either and publish, either because you directed us to or because it's relevant information. And then also early this year, we established, in addition to having public use files available, we established a dashboard that you see here on the right, through which people with varying degrees of technical ability can look up information on healthcare in Minnesota.
Okay, Mr. Gildemeister, we're going to have to conclude. And members, he will send the slides, so you'll have the slide deck that you can look at. We just really don't have time to do much more today. We need to get to the bill.
That's what I meant to present.
Thank you. All right, Representative Elkins, I think we have one testifier. Did you want to say more now before we call the testifier?
No.
Okay, so Dr. Vazuni again. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, I am still Dr. Alex Vazuni, President of the Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians, here today in strong support of HF 926. HF 926 is needed to update the all-payer claims database, known as the APCD, to ensure that it collects a complete picture on how health care is paid for in Minnesota. Currently, it only collects payments that are found on insurance claims. It is missing a large portion of payments, non-claims-based payments, including value-based payments, infrastructure costs, care coordination, and other patient support services. Minnesota All-Payer Claims Database was created in 2008 to gather data from all of Minnesota's payers on how we pay for healthcare services. This has been an invaluable tool used to analyze variations in healthcare costs and quality, study hospital readmissions, and trends for specific chronic conditions as more. As we work to ensure that Minnesotans have access to high-quality, affordable healthcare, both national and international data shows that the greater investment in primary care and prevention results in better care and lower costs. However, before Minnesota can move forward with that, we need a clearer, more comprehensive picture of healthcare spending in our state. We need to capture all the ways that we're paying for healthcare to understand how to make our health system work best for the people it serves and to ensure that we are getting value for our healthcare spending. Without this data, how do we, policymakers, healthcare team members, and patients, set a vision for a system that works for all Minnesotans? HF 926 also directs the commissioner to report to the legislature the volume and distribution of healthcare spending with a particular focus on value-based care models and primary care spending. HF 926 is critical to you as policymakers to know how healthcare is paid for in Minnesota and to help inform the next steps in making our healthcare payment system work best for our states and all Minnesotans.
All right, thank you. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on this bill? All right, not seeing any, so we'll close the testimony. And Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think, you know, the original intent of the APCD was, and as has been mentioned, a research tool. So I have some concerns about the disclosure, the level of disclosure that's going to happen now. The way I read this bill, and certainly lines 2.24 and 2.5, and then again on 3.3 to 3.5, it looks like we will be disclosing it publicly information on providers. And is that the intention, to actually publish the names of physicians and anyone associated, because that's what this language would allow for?
Representative Elkins, and I think you're referring to the amendment.
Oh, correct. Thank you, okay. Madam Chair. Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So right. This language was very carefully negotiated with all of the stakeholders, and it explicitly does not go down to the individual provider level. It's limited to practice level price information. So it would be a healthcare practice, not an individual provider.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess, you know, I believe your intent. I'm always just very cautious about the words on the page.
Sure.
And it says, notwithstanding data classification in this paragraph, data on providers collected under this subdivision may be released or published as authorized in subdivision 11. So I have real concerns about making that data public and what that might do to physicians. I'm not sure that that's the intent.
And Representative Elkins, didn't this bill originate with some of the medical groups?
Parts of it.
Okay. Anyway, please address the question.
No. So the term provider refers to a broad term in healthcare. Refers to either practices or practitioners. But I'm pretty sure in the language it is now saying that it's referring specifically to practice level information. Certainly the intent. If it doesn't say that, I'll fix it in Commerce. But that was very carefully negotiated. Yeah, and I would add, Madam Chair, that in the state of Florida, for example, this is the primary, they use their all-payer claims database to do price reporting to the public. If you can go to, they have a price compare website where they're, you know, showing prices by practice based on their historical APCD data.
Yeah, and Representative Elkins, I don't know if this was mentioned, but don't most or all states have an APCD at this point? I think it's very common.
Last count, there are about 14, how many, seven? 17 oh, okay. States that have a, and more are adding them all the time.
All right, thank you. All right. All right, seeing no further discussion, Representative Elkins, do you want to wrap up?
No, this was, I think that the testimony has pretty much covered it. So with that, Madam Chair, I'll move that we re-refer this one as well to the Commerce Department.
All right, so the motion then is that House File 296 as amended be re-referred to the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails, and the bill is on its way. So that is the end of the agenda for today, members. We are hearing a bunch of lead bills on Thursday, so we're doing a big shift of topic here. But so thank you very much for, thank you, Representative Elkins. Great job, and we stand adjourned.